The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Conley, Judge Larkin, Judge Shellhouse, the Honorable Francis J. Conley presiding.
Thank you very much. Our final case this morning is case file 820-0014, Charity Slaughter versus Independent School District Number 833. As all parties are aware, counsel for Ms. Slaughter will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Counsel for the school district will have 15 minutes. And then finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So whenever counsel for Ms. Slaughter is ready to proceed, just tell us who you are in a loud voice and you may begin. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. This is Leslie Lieneman on behalf of the appellant, Charity Slaughter. This morning, we are here on a case, an employment case, brought under the Minnesota Whistleblower Act and also the Minnesota OSHA reprisal statute. I think it's worth noting that a week ago, the Minnesota Supreme Court decided another employment case, Kenna versus Homeward Bound. This obviously would not have been in our briefing. It is not a whistleblower case, but it is an employment case. And in that case, the Supreme Court again cautioned against dismissing employment cases on summary judgment because they often turn on questions of reasonableness. And in this case, we have identified both legal errors and I think errors in weighing of the evidence by the district court. Essentially, the district court giving the benefit of the doubt to the employer in this case, rather than giving the benefit of the doubt to the evidence submitted by the employee, Ms. Slaughter. The Whistleblower Act is substantially an act about public policy, and I would describe the policy of that act as, if you see something, say something. The nature of the Whistleblower Act is that when employees who are not lawyers, but they feel that there is something that is unsafe or perhaps illegal, they should be encouraged to report those issues to their employer or to government agencies. And when they do, they should be protected from adverse action. In this case, there were a number of, let me say that the typically retaliation claims under both statutes, whistleblower statute and Minnesota OSHA reprisal, have three elements: protected conduct, adverse action, and a causal connection. Here, the district court properly found some of the conduct that to be protected conduct. We disagree with the determination by the district court that other aspects of the conduct were not protected. Specifically, with respect to the drinking allegation, one of the reports of protected conduct by Ms. Slaughter was that her coworker was drinking in his car at the school district on work hours, and that was found to be true. And within weeks after she reported that, she was fired the first time. Now, she got her job back, but even being fired and getting her job back, that is an adverse action. That is a violation of the Whistleblower Act.
Counsel, yes. This is Judge Larkin. As I'm sure you're aware, our review in this case is de novo, so we're not called upon to kind of critique the district court judge's reasoning, but rather to decide de novo whether or not summary judgment was appropriate. So that's the approach I'm taking to the case and your arguments. With that in mind, would you tell me what the record shows as best evidence of causation? That is, as to the 2014 termination, what evidence suggests that that was in retaliation for reporting the co-workers drinking on school grounds?
Two things. One was the timing. She had started her employment in June of that year. This occurred in July and August, and within 2 weeks of the start of the school year, she was fired. Michael Greiner, who was at the time the decision maker, said that he fired her because of complaints about her cleaning during that first 2 weeks of school. But the person he identified as the person who had complained to him about that was Principal Mast. Principal Mast testified in her deposition that she did not have any complaints about Ms. Slaughter's cleaning during that period of time. And so we have timing that it followed shortly after her protected conduct, and also what we call pretext, which is that witnesses have conflicting testimony about what happened in that time frame. We have one person saying she had issues with cleaning and the person who was on site saying she did not. And so that's a jury issue, you know, which of those two things.
Why would a reasonable juror conclude that she was fired in retaliation for reporting the use of alcohol on school property. I mean, as I understand the record, she reported that the school investigated and the person who had been using the alcohol was terminated from his employment. Doesn't that suggest that the school valued her report and acted appropriately on her report?
Yeah, the evidence that, in addition to the timing, is, you know, she's hired to clean. The school was in session for 2 weeks, and we have differing testimony about why. In other words, the principal says, no, there were no performance issues. Michael Griner says
also,
there were.
I guess, I think my concern with your argument is that you seem to be saying, well, it must have been because she made this report, because otherwise the evidence is conflicting. But why would the school fire her for making a report that they acted on in a way that appeared to be appropriate?
Because she was a new employee and she was a probationary employee, and they could. But ultimately, the jury determines those questions when we have conflicting evidence. We have two people who are the decision makers who tell two different stories.
But you have to show that there was causation, that she was fired in 2014 because she made the report about her coworker drinking. And in terms of the evidence you proffer to avoid summary judgment on that point, the evidence is simply the timing, because they occurred, the report and the termination occurred within a month or so of each other.
The timing and the issue of pretext. Pretext can be used both at the causation stage and at the pretext stage. Under the McDonnell-Douglas analysis. And so
you still need causation. I mean, before you get to pretext, you need causation.
Actually, the case law is that giving a pretextual reason for the termination can be evidence of causation. It can be used in both prongs of the McDonnell-Douglas test.
Okay. Thank you.
So moving on to the to the 2017 timeframe, there are a number of areas in which she engaged in protected conduct. One is the air quality concern that were reflected in her daily logs and her report to OSHA. That tracks with conduct that was found by the Minnesota Supreme Court to be protected conduct in the Abraham case cited in our materials. The second one is the level of lead in the water, that although the levels of lead, the issue of the lead being there was old. What she was raising in 2017 was that three of the sources of the lead contaminated water had not been repaired. And that was the current issue there. And then the third was her concern about leaving the building unsecured when she was the person whose job duty it was to secure the building. Those we believe are protected areas of protected conduct. So I'd like to just talk a little bit about causation, because of course it is an essential element here. And causation can be proved by direct evidence or circumstantial. That's a broad swath, but I think there is both here. First, direct evidence, the termination letter itself says that her raising these issues and insisting on locking the fire doors was one of the reasons for a termination. So we have direct evidence, and then we have the circumstantial evidence of the timing, and then the credibility issues that we've identified with some of the other reasons given for her termination. Like, you know, they were reviewing video of her to capture her wearing shorts that they had known she had been wearing for a long time, that they said they had documentation reflecting that she had not vacuumed when they actually did not have that documentation, and she was not supposed to be vacuuming every day. She was supposed to be vacuuming on a rotating schedule. And then the issue of the vacuum. Her supervisor tells her, hey, if you don't want other people used to the vacuum, what I have done in other circumstances is hide the vacuum. So she moves the vacuum to a different place. The principal uses video to say, aha, she moved it to a different place, and that's used as one reason to terminate her. Given the evidence that her supervisor sort of gave her the roadmap to do that, we believe that is pretext. So again, we have timing and pretext as elements of causation here. I want to talk a little bit about the differences, the legal differences between the Whistleblower Act and Minnesota OSHA. Minnesota OSHA reprisal statute has a broader section and it has a narrower section. And the Minnesota Supreme Court considered both of those in the Abraham case as well. In other words, that the scope of the Minnesota OSHA protections doesn't necessarily mean that you have to report a violation of law, but rather a concern about workplace safety. And so there is the provision also that protects a person who refuses to do something because they believe they're in imminent danger. In this case, we have both of those under the Minnesota OSHA statute. She reports concerns about workplace safety with the lead in the water and the air quality and the fire doors. And then she also says at the time, you know, she believed that she was in imminent danger, but both of those types of claims must be considered under the Minnesota OSHA reprisal statute separately from the question of whether those rise to the level of being a suspected violation of law. So those statutes have to be.
Isn't the standard imminent danger of death or serious physical harm?
In one of the provisions, yes. The Minnesota OSHA reprisal retaliation provision has two separate provisions. The broader one is the one that was addressed in the Abraham case, which is simply when she makes a report to OSHA about a workplace safety concern, which she did in her letter to OSHA. That was also a reiteration of her daily logs. And so there are actually two different provisions at play here in Minnesota OSHA reprisal. And they actually relate to different aspects of her report. The one relates to the air quality and the lead, and the other relates to the closing of the fire doors.
So the closing of the fire doors, and that relates to refusal to perform an assigned task, which requires her to present some evidence raising a genuine issue of material fact that she was in imminent danger of death or serious physical harm. What was the imminent danger of death or serious physical harm resulting from keeping the fire doors unlocked from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m.?
So I have two responses because this issue goes to both statutes, and again, it's different under both statutes. For her, there had been a number of unauthorized people accessing the building in that couple of week period. This is at the beginning of the school year. She had found people who are not authorized to be in the building. So she had concerns.
Between 4 and 5 p.m.?
Yes, actually. And what her concern was is that people who access the building during that time can go into the secured area, the area that could be secured by the fire doors, and remain there undetected. And she had the responsibility of removing people. She had spoken with Principal Jolene Mast, and Principal Mast had instructed her that her job duty did include removing individuals from that area.
Where in the record do we find evidence that she encountered people between 4 and 5 p.m. that weren't authorized to be there? I recall reading that she encountered someone at 10 p.m. who was actually a construction worker who was authorized to be there. She encountered somebody outside of the building near the trash dumpster, which wouldn't be related to this issue of locking the doors. What specific evidence can you point us to in the record that indicates that there were unauthorized people in the building between 4 and 5 p.m. that could have legitimately presented imminent danger of death or serious physical harm?
In both her deposition and the deposition of Principal Mast, their testimony aligns that there were a group of young, I can't remember if they were mixed gender, but young people who are older than elementary school, who she found in the media area, which is in that area that should be secured, who are not authorized to be there. And that was the discussion that they had when she spoke with Principal Mast, reported it, and asked whether her job duties included removing these people, and the principal confirmed that. So that was the issue that-
her position is a group of older children who were in the media area presented an immediate danger of death or serious physical harm.
So sure,
her refusal to follow a supervisor's directive regarding when to lock doors.
So they were like teenagers, essentially teenagers running in the building, in the elementary school building, in an area that should have been secured
What I'm struggling with is how we go from teenagers who are unauthorized to be in that area of the building to teenagers who posed an imminent danger of death or serious physical harm to your client.
Well, I don't think you can say as a matter of law that three teenagers are not an imminent threat to one person working alone in a building.
Do you have any law that indicates that it's reasonable to conclude that three teenagers in a school building between the areas of hours 4 p.m. and 5 p.m. present an imminent danger of serious physical harm or death? I mean, you seem to be presuming that teenagers are killers. I mean, if they're not supposed to be in the building, we're going to presume that they create this risk?
No,
it seems you have a pretty high burden here.
It's actually, in my view, the flip of the summary judgment standard. We're not presuming they are, but we can't presume that they aren't. It particularly,
but to survive summary judgment, you have to raise a genuine issue of material fact, which means a dispute that would allow a reasonable person to conclude that the circumstances you describe cause your employee to reasonably believe that she was in imminent danger of death or serious physical harm between the areas of 4 p.m. and 5 p.m. at work.
Well, I can tell you that
a person would believe that.
A number of school shooters have been teenagers who have been armed. Yes, I believe it is reasonable to conclude, based upon Columbine and Sandy Hook and a number of other school shootings where the active shooters were teenagers, that that's not an unreasonable fear for her to have in our current environment. Now, I also want to look at that under the Whistleblower Act, which is a very different standard. We're not on an imminent risk of imminent harm anymore under the Whistleblower Act. Under the Whistleblower Act,
your time has expired. I'll let you sort of address that issue on rebuttal, though.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning. My name is Kristen Nierengarten, and I represent Respondent Independent School District number 833 in this matter. Now, it's easy to get bogged down in appellant's attempts to sensationalize the facts of this case, but the starting point for a summary judgment analysis is to look at the law and the elements that a plaintiff must prove to prevail on her claims. In this case, as Ms. Lineman said, the appellant's claims were retaliation under the Whistleblower Act and retaliation under the Minnesota OSHA statute, both of which require that she put forth evidence that she engaged in protected conduct. Under the Whistleblower Act, protected conduct arises when the employee makes a good faith report implicating a violation of law. Now, the courts have said that reporting subjective notions of wrongdoing or just problematic or even reprehensible conduct is not sufficient to establish protected conduct under that act. Instead, the courts have specifically said, the court in Kratzer versus Welsh Companies said that the proper standard to apply is to assume the facts have occurred as reported and then determine whether those facts constitute a violation of law. The court went on to clarify that in order to find that an employee engaged in protected conduct, there doesn't need to be an actual violation of the law because the facts might not be as they were reported by that employee, but the law alleged to have been violated actually has to exist. So, breaking down that analysis, this requires the court to identify what the report was, what facts were reported, assume those are true, and then look at the law and compare the reported facts to the law to determine whether there was actually a report of a violation of law. If there was, then the employee engaged in whistleblower protected conduct, and the court goes on to analyze the other elements of a prima facie case of retaliation. In this case, it's really not clear what appellant's theory is of whistleblower retaliation. She doesn't apply this analytical framework for identifying protected conduct. Any of the potpourri of her complaints that she hypothesizes might have been underlying her termination. The only complaint that she can tie to the district's termination is her complaint about the interior fire doors and her belief that they should have been locked at 4 p.m. instead of 5 p.m. Appellant admitted in her deposition, though, that she, when she was complaining about this issue, she did not suspect that the district was engaging in a violation of law. Instead, this issue.
Does the record indicate whether at this particular school between 4 and 5 there are extracurricular activities?
The record talks about how there was a kids club, kind of an after school care happening, and there were also activities happening in the gym and around the school.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so that gets to this point. I mean, I don't know this case as well as you do, but I mean, I'm shocked that anyone would be locking fire doors between 9 and 5. I mean, if you lock fire doors and there's a fire, people can't get out and they'll die. So
I'm just amazed that, you know, that people were discussing locking fire doors at all. I mean, I get it, people can come in at, you know, odd hours, and maybe if everyone knows the fire doors are never locked, you get in. But I mean, it seems to me the reverse, to lock fire doors and keep, you know, I just think that would be a disaster. So I'm troubled by the appellant just saying she was going to lock the fire doors at all. It seems to me that's, does the record indicate that there's a policy or an ordinance or a rule about keeping fire doors open at all times or during a school day?
So what the record has in it is a policy that goes to building security, and it says that it's up to the principal to determine things like locking the doors. It doesn't specifically say when the doors have to be locked. It doesn't say that the internal doors ever have to be locked, but it says that those types of decisions are left to the principal. Likewise, there's no law, common law or statute, that goes to the locking of interior fire doors. There's nothing in the record about that.
Does the record indicate, so, you know, she was sort of a custodial person. I mean, is there a safety? I mean, is this her job to determine? I mean, does she have any input on whether doors are locked or not? I mean, I would assume the safety coordinator would have some discussion, but is that part of her job description?
It is her job to lock the doors when the district decides the doors need to be locked. It is not her job to decide when the doors are supposed to be locked. And I will say that in her deposition, she takes a contrary stance on that. However, the evidence in the record is the policy. The actual policy is in the record and says that those types of security decisions are up to the principal when it comes to the building. And the principal's got training about building security. So again, this goes back to what is the claim that she's trying to mount with this claim, assertion that the fire doors needed to be locked at a certain hour? Well, so this goes back to her subjective notions of safety and what's right and what's wrong. And now she's trying to shoehorn those subjective notions into a claim that her complaints implicated common law negligence and thus underlie her whistleblower claim. Appellant has not identified any case extending whistleblower protection to an assertion of negligence. But even still, if we tried to apply that framework that we talked about just a few minutes ago, this whistleblower framework, the court would be required to identify what were the facts reported to the school district and how do those stack up against the law to determine whether there was an actual violation of the law. So in other words, did the facts that appellant reported establish negligence? The facts that appellant reported were that the doors should be locked at 4 p.m. instead of 5 p.m. because there were unauthorized people in the building. That's it. So then you compare that to the elements of negligence. You know, you have to look at duty, breach, causation, damages, whether there was the breach caused the damages. Well, the facts that she reported don't touch on the vast majority of any of these elements. And what appellant wants to do on appeal is just to argue about whether the district had a duty. And as we just discussed, the district didn't have a specific duty with respect to the fire doors. There's no law requiring that the fire doors be locked here. And there were no facts reported by the appellant that would create a foreseeable risk of harm that would give rise to a duty. She didn't report a specific threat. She didn't report aggression. She didn't even cite this hyperbolic claim about school shootings. She didn't cite that when she complained to the district. As to the students in the school and that issue, the older students who were in the school, she says in her deposition that she wasn't afraid of kids. That wasn't her concern. So to find whistleblower protection premised on this complaint about the fire doors, the court would essentially have to conclude that the combination of unauthorized people in the building, which is what she reported, and the district not wanting to lock the fire doors at 4 p.m. was in and of itself a violation of law. But that's not what the law says. And the purpose of whistleblower protection is not for the court to establish new rules of law or new requirements for employers. And it's not to provide unfettered protection for employees who simply do not like the directives that they receive. As such, the district court properly concluded that these complaints about the interior fire door didn't implicate a violation of law, and they weren't protected conduct. Now, as appellant's counsel was saying, that these same facts go to her claims under the Minnesota OSHA statute and her refusal to work in September of 2017. Now, a refusal to work is protected conduct only when the refusal is because of a reasonable belief that the working conditions pose a threat of imminent danger of death or serious physical harm to the employee. And then the employee must also have communicated those concerns to the employer before she refused to work and to have acted in good faith when she refused to work. Appellant refused to work in this case because she couldn't lock the fire doors at 4 p.m. because the principal said don't lock them before 5 p.m. She admitted in her deposition that there wasn't an imminent threat. There was no pending danger of physical harm to her. Instead, she said in her deposition that the only time when she was at work that she felt like she was in imminent danger was in February of 2016. And that was when there was an incident outside of the school at 9 p.m. in February, it's dark at 9 p.m., when there was an unknown person by the dumpsters. That was a year and a half before she refused to work because she couldn't lock the interior doors, which would not have been impacted. Would not have made a difference in that case. She refused to work because she couldn't lock those doors. But she does not cite any threats. As I said she did not feel threatened by the presence of students in the school, older students in the school. She did not cite any incident that would have been thwarted had the fire doors been locked. All she cited was the unknown. Now, she didn't communicate. I mean, further, she didn't communicate any specific condition that posed a threat of imminent harm to the district before she refused to act or before she refused to work. It does not matter that she didn't like the directive that she was given. It does not matter that she subjectively believed that there were better safety decisions. It does not matter that she wanted a better explanation from the principal about why the principal made the decision that she did about the fire doors. All that matters is that the decision about when to lock the fire doors did not put appellant in a position of imminent danger. Because of that, she didn't engage in protected conduct when she refused to work. And I want to note one other thing about this whistleblower claim. So appellant's counsel is starting to talk about how this concern about air quality and water quality also go to this whistleblower, Minnesota OSHA retaliation issue. That is not an argument that she's raised before. I do not know what portion of the statute she's talking about. That is not an issue that was raised before this court before now. By repeatedly complaining about and refusing to comply with the directives from the principal about the interior fire doors at the school building, appellant was essentially arguing that it was her right, asserting that it was her right to run the building. As part of that, she was saying that if she subjectively felt like locking the doors at 4 p.m. instead of 5 p.m. was safer, then the principal had to accept that and had to go along with that. If that were the case, then the district would have no control over its school buildings, no control over its building security. There would be nothing that would stop appellant or any other employee, for that matter, from, you know, for instance, refusing to comply with the requirement to fully lock down the school when there is an actual threat. Because that person, whether it's appellant or another employee, subjectively believes that leaving all of the doors in the building unlocked is better because that would allow that employee to run out of the building more easily. Again, allowing an employee to make these subjective decisions would hamstring the district from imposing any type of discipline on an employee who refuses to comply with a safety measure based on that employee's subjective beliefs about safety. And it would hamstring the district because that would be considered retaliation. Disciplining them for not following safety protocols would be considered retaliation for protected conduct. So to be clear, appellant's job was not to determine safety protocol. Her job was to comply with the directives that she was given. Her job was to work and clean the buildings at night and to do so in a manner that was consistent with the directives she received. She was not being directed to do anything that was illegal. She was not being directed to do anything that put her in imminent danger. She was being asked to do her job, to vacuum, to secure the building per the principal's instructions, to communicate respectfully, truthfully, and in a manner consistent with building processes. She was being asked to follow the district's policies. She was being asked to not to try to veto the principal's decisions, whether it was the decision about when the doors could be locked or whether it was the decision about making a staff vacuum available to everyone. But she refused to comply with those reasonable directives, and she refused to respect the authority of her supervisors. That is why she was terminated. Because appellant has failed to present evidence establishing that she can meet essential elements of her claims against the district respectfully requests that this court uphold the district court's proper grant of summary judgment dismissing all of her baseless claims against the district. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for the appellant, you will have rebuttal now. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to go back to your question, Judge Conley. With respect to the fire doors, it's important to understand that the area enclosed in the fire doors is the area where people were not supposed to be. In other words, extracurricular activities were on the outside of that area. And so that was why the only person who was supposed to be in there was the cleaning personnel or people who have a key. The other thing about the fire doors is you can open them from the inside. So you wouldn't be trapped in there in case of a fire. You can open them from the inside. It's just about who had access to it. And being able to seal off the building so that the people who were there for basketball practice or a public event would be directed into the correct area of the building. Thank you for that question, because I think that was a very important point. With respect to OSHA, counsel just indicated that she'd not heard this OSHA retaliation claim with respect to the air and water quality, but the district court did hear the claim and did find that the OSHA report regarding the air quality was protected conduct. So this was raised at the district court level, and the court did find that it was protected conduct under the Minnesota OSHA retaliation statute. But what I really want to focus in here is this issue of what it means to have good faith under the Whistleblower Act, because each of the people who I deposed, the decision makers and the managers, they all testified that they believed that Ms. Slaughter's reports were genuine and her intentions were good. She was genuinely concerned about the lead in the water. She was genuinely concerned about the health of the people who were working in the building. They all agree with that. And also, she didn't, under the Whistleblower Act, it's a defined term. She didn't falsely report something. She wasn't falsely reporting when the doors were opened or closed. In fact, it was verified that when doors were propped open inappropriately, those facts were found to be true. So under the Whistleblower Act's definition of good faith, these were good faith reports. And the defendants don't doubt that at all. But it's also important to recognize what her job was. She was a custodian, but she was also, once the staff left, the teachers left at about 3:30, she was also the only district employee in the building for most of her shift. And she was given the task of confronting people who didn't belong and of securing the building, according to Principal Mast. And so the concept that she was, you know, her job was cleaning toilets and wasn't securing the building, it's not true. It was both. And it's a difficult job to do by yourself, and it's a difficult job to do when you don't have a title like principal. And so she had to use her best judgment and try to secure the building in a way that made it safe for the children, made it safe for the employees the next day, to be sure that people who were needed to be in the building could be, and people who shouldn't be in areas of the building where it was shouldn't be. There is this whistleblower amendment that added the concept of common law. In other words, a report of a suspected violation of common law is protected conduct. Now, it's particularly difficult for a non-lawyer to articulate that, I realize. You know, it's as lawyers, we can't always say, you know, what is negligence in any particular situation. It's even harder for a layperson. So I think the law has to give some margin there for a non-lawyer to say, I can't point to a statute, but I believe there are unsafe conditions on the premises. And that's what she did. And I believe that is what was anticipated by the Whistleblower Act, because if it isn't, why is it in there? This was an amendment that was put in by the legislature several years ago, I believe for this very reason, for employees to be able to say, I do think we owe a duty that we're missing here, or I think there is an unsafe condition existing in this workplace. And so I'm bringing it forward, even if I don't have the legal ability to articulate it. So I think that we need to find a way to give meaning to that amendment because we have to give meaning to words of the legislature. And this is the type of case that really, you know, really draws us to that notion of what was the legislature trying to accomplish here. And I think that this is a very good example of what that is. Ms. Slaughter was in a position of having to secure the building. She did so to the best of her ability. And it clearly contributed to her termination. It was articulated at the time in the letter that this was the reason that she was being let go, or one of the reasons. So she meets the causation standard here. Clearly this issue, that her raising the question of whether the duty was being met, contributed to her termination. I see that I'm out of time. I thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you, counsel, for the appellant, counsel for the respondent. The matter is submitted. We appreciate your participating by WebEx, and we hope you stay safe. Thank you. We are adjourned.